The industrialization of America's agriculture has made it possible for a very few farmers to grow most all of the nation's food. But some say America's agriculture is bound to collapse. And so we ask, why would our agriculture collapse?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1241st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in La Paz who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, the good Lord gave America the world's best environment for growing food, and Americans took advantage of that environment and developed the world's most productive agriculture. Never before have so few farmers grown so much food. American agriculture was made to be so productive through the process of industrialization, which is a big word, but the formula is really quite simple. It takes time, money, and know-how to grow a crop. Time is the investment of labor, as in the farmer is out working in his field. Money is the investment of capital, as in the farmer borrows money to buy a tractor. And know-how is the investment of knowledge, as in the farmer knows how to plant seeds and harvest a crop. Now, the key to understanding industrialization is the proportion by which the investments of time, money, and know-how are made. In the days of Thomas Jefferson, farmers had a lot of time, very little money, and just enough know-how. As a consequence, the farms tended to be labor-intensive subsistence enterprises, and their principal crops tended to be their families. But after World War II, Americans were called off the farm to work in the city, and this migration forced a change in the relative value of time and money. Time became very expensive because there were so few farmers left out in the country to grow food. Money became very cheap because the inflating value of farmland gave farmers money in the bank. Given this change in the value of time and money, farmers had to develop the know-how to grow crops with money instead of time. So instead of spending time hoeing weeds, farmers spend money to buy herbicides. This new kind of know-how allowed farmers to grow the size of their farms to achieve economies of scale. Whereas a farmer in Jefferson's day may have farmed 100 acres, today's farmer might farm 10,000 acres and do so without any weed or insect pests. The industrialization of agriculture made it possible for most everyone to live in the comfort of the city and to earn a living by pushing digital bits of information up into a cloud. As such, America's industrial agriculture is truly miraculous. But some say the true costs of industrializing America's agriculture have not been paid, and that when those costs must be paid, agriculture is bound to collapse. And so today we pause to ask, why would American agriculture collapse, and what can be done to prevent such a collapse? And here to help us dig up some answers, we have Tom Philpott, who is the author of Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming, and How We Can Prevent It. Tom, welcome to the Food Chain. I like the last part of your subtitle here, How We Can Prevent It. The first part is kind of scary.
No doubt. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you aboard. So you're a farmer, a journalist, a farm critic, and have been at it for a long time. But I'd like to start, if we can, with your Maverick Farms.
Sure. So long about 2004, I was living in New York City and was getting more and more into food, was involved in a community garden in Brooklyn. I was working as a financial journalist, but I was spending a lot of my free time cooking and eating and Being involved in the community garden movement in New York really sort of was kind of a crash course in just how political food is. Because at the time, Mayor Giuliani was trying to, you know, basically sell community gardens that were, a public good, selling them to his real estate mates. And in that process, I got really politicized in food, and I had the chance to move to a really small farm in the rural Appalachian Mountains, North Carolina, far west of the state, outside of the town of Boone. And so that's how that project started. It was, my girlfriend's family land and, several friends, from up in New York moved with us, and we took over her family's farm and, immediately began to experiment with new economic models because, the area was very kind of dominated by tourism. And so most farms in the area that were still existing, this was, basically tobacco country, burley tobacco. And, when that market collapsed, a lot of farms went out of business.
So there's lots of land then, right?
Well, there's not very much bottom land. Uh-huh. It's a very mountainous area. And, the land was very expensive because, basically it's an area where a lot of New Yorkers and people from the Northeast moved to Florida, realized that it's, unbearably hot in the summer.
And so flat, too.
And so they move halfway back. They go to the mountains in North Carolina, where the summers are really nice. And so there's tremendous development pressure.
Yeah. Well, what really caught my attention about your Maverick. Are you the Maverick in Maverick Farms, or were there a bunch of Mavericks in Maverick?
Oh, no, it was a complete collective. And, obviously if we had known that, I guess John McCain existed as a thing, but we weren't thinking about him at all. But when, when 2008 came around, we weren't too happy with the name. But, no, it was very, very, very much of a collective.
Okay. So what really captured my attention was how you found yourself competing with California agriculture.
Yeah. And so, our operation was pretty small and pretty niche. And one of the things that we did was we sold salad greens to restaurants. And salad greens were very much the thing that we were most proud of. They were, just a mix of, as many as 8 or 9 different greens, arugula, Asian greens like Han Shan Thai, just a whole variety of greens. We also did baby kale, baby chard. And we'd make these incredible mixes. And so one day, this is in the introduction to the book, I was doing my weekly calls to chefs, and the chef at this really nice restaurant who had been buying our salad greens for years and buying from our predecessor, the guy who ran the farm before us, he asked me, hey, can you come down a little bit on the price? And, we just had a conversation and I explained, these are really labor intensive and, this is basically our this fall crop that we're doing. This is the bread and butter of our operation. And so it's really, really hard for us to come down on the price. And he said, well, I was not able to get my hands on organic greens before, but my distributor is offering me these organic greens from California, and they're not nearly as good as you guys, but they're acceptable. And if you guys can't come down and meet the price, I'm going to have to go with them. And so I held steady, and basically it became for him a niche product, like a thing to put on plates to make it pretty for a special. But we got swept aside by this California alternative. And then we started seeing that, and I think this was 2006, and we started seeing that happen to other crops that we grew, that just, you know, suddenly just these little niche markets that we had, and then we had developed over years between us and our predecessor, you know, we're suddenly getting this ruthless competition from California.
Well, and there it was. A similar thing happened to me. I was growing elephant garlic in the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon and selling it to Bloomingdale's in New York City and making some good money doing that. If you think about the great label we had, you know, we were growing in the Rogue River Valley of Southern Oregon, so we had this Rogue Elephant logo. It's really cool. And having fun. And we were even in the initial stages of establishing a cooperative of a bunch of small growers and putting them together because we were selling a lot of garlic. But then one day, the Chinese came to town with a shipload of organic elephant garlic. And it was very cheap. And there went our market. Just poof,
right,
like that.
Yep.
So we both kind of had the same kind of experience trying to go up against these Goliaths. So there we are. We're kind of stuck with that. And in that regard, how does one compete with Goliaths that are so big and they have all of these advantages? But the real advantage they seem to have, from my way of thinking, is the ability to not pay the true costs of production. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the, definitely one of the aspects that undergirds the industry. And, you know, in the book, the way that I was thinking about it was, I mean, I think that fact is often overlooked in conventional economic analyses. And I remember getting into a debate, because not long after that, I started writing for Grist magazine and writing about food politics in the mid-2000s. And I got into just an internet debate, let's say, with this guy, Professor Sexton. I think Steve Sexton is his name, out of Duke University, who was writing for the Freakonomics blog. And he had this big piece about how, you know, comparative advantage tells us that we should not actually even think about buying local food, because, you know, basically California has got this incredible comparative advantage of this Mediterranean climate, you know, where in, you know, much of the state, including the Central Valley, you can basically grow food year round. It's got these water resources, the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Why would you ever grow food when it can come from this place? And of course, what he didn't mention was the labor question, obviously, that the state.
So there are some significant costs that really haven't quite been paid. And when people say, yeah, they're making cheap food, well, if you look at some of the costs that haven't been paid, maybe the cheap food really isn't after all. So when we come back, I'd like to pick up the what you see to be the causes of the pending collapse of American agriculture. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Tom Philpott, who is the author of Perilous Bounty. And you, of course, are with us as well. Why would our agriculture collapse? Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Tom Philpott, for your book Perilous Bounty, you traveled around the country, but kind of seemed to focus on California in the Midwest. Why is that?
I focus on those places because they are the two really key nodes to the U.S. food system. These are the two places where the great bulk of our food comes from. Obviously, there are other places where people grow lots of food. There's Florida. There's the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. But if you look at the numbers, these are the powerhouses, basically fruits and vegetables to California, and the corn and soybeans that infiltrates and drives the meat industry, you know, basically comes from the Midwest. So when you're looking at the food system where it's really concentrated, it's those two places.
And I guess it's all made possible by a lot of diesel fuel.
There is certainly a lot of energy and sort of reliance on cheap and easy energy embedded in the system in both places.
Yeah, if you can grow strawberries in California and eat them in New York City, and it takes diesel fuel or a Jet A to get it there. Well, before the break, you mentioned labor, and I think if there's a good illustration of the true costs of production, labor would be certainly one of them. I often think that if people believe in cheap labor, look at the cost of slavery, and that's not been cheap at all, and it's been a world-class tragedy all the way through. But way back when, somebody had the notion that they could get cheap labor by going to Africa and enslaving people and bringing them here and putting them to work on their farms. And they may have had cheap labor for a while, but in the real sense, in the real world, it hasn't been cheap at all. And what you saw or happening with California labor is another indication that cheap food isn't, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the conditions, the wages, the places where the people who harvest our food, where they live, most people don't understand just how grueling it is and just, you know, the environmental impacts of this kind of food production. A lot of it is hidden from the view of most consumers. So, you know, talking about, costs that are unnoticed, that aren't priced into the system, you know, you can eat conventional strawberries from California or a nice juicy hamburger fed by corn and soybeans from the Midwest and not really know much about the environmental damage. And those environmental costs are imposed directly on the people who are doing the work. They're doing the work in places that are out of sight and out of mind for most people who live in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our neck of the woods, we see them all just driving down the road. They're out there in the fields working. And, you know, a lot of them are making pretty good money. And it appears as though the labor laws here in California are being changed significantly with respect to minimum wages and overtime and all kinds of different things.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this is a positive development obviously it's a positive development. So minimum wage laws, the 40-hour work week with guarantees for time and a half overtime, these are things that American workers and workers across the world struggled really hard for. And they were enshrined in U.S. law during the New Deal era, with one giant exception, and that's basically domestic labor and farm labor. And it doesn't take a lot of, you don't need to be a historian to figure out why those two aspects would be excluded. Basically, it was, FDR cutting a deal with Southern Democrats who wanted to make sure in that 1940s era that they were still able to exploit black people. And so, you know, basically minimum wage laws and overtime laws did not apply to those two groups. And slowly but surely, most states are imposing them, at least for farm labor. And that's happening in California. And so California, farm owners very soon, I think maybe next year, are going to have to pay time and a half overtime to farm workers who work more than 40 hours. And it's shocking how much of an impact that's going to have. I mean, I think it goes back to how much they rely on exploitation that, you know, what I'm hearing from farmers is that the most labor-intensive kinds of crops are going to move south to Mexico, where they have fewer labor protections, and California farming is going to get more, shift more and more into things that can be mechanized, like almond production being the most famous example. Very few human hands are involved in almond production, and so that makes it very. That's one of the reasons that makes it very attractive to California farmers.
Mm-hmm. And what impact will those prices have on prices of food? I mean, if did you get a feel for how much the labor laws and the wage laws are going to change the costs of doing business?
I think they're, I mean, you know, whenever a change like that is imposed on an industry, they always cry foul. They always declare that it's the end of the industry. We simply can't, you know, follow this environmental rule or this labor rule. And usually that ends up being wrong. But, you know, farming is it is definitely a very low margin business. And so I think that the way that, I think the cost effects of that particular law are going to be pretty muted for a while, because what you are going to see, and we've already been seeing this in the past 10 or 15 years, is that, you know, if you go south of California into Mexico, there's really very similar growing regions.
Right.
Baja California, other places like that. And you're going to see crops that take a lot of human hands. And it could be the same owner. A lot of California owners own land in Mexico.
Sure.
They're going to shift the stuff that requires a lot of human hands as much as possible down to Mexico, and so that will, you know, keep the price down for consumers and keep the costs of exploitation out of sight and out of mind, and you know the whole cycle will continue. But, you know, in the book, I talk about other things that I think are going to be more immediately, you know, potentially affecting prices.
But it seemed to be perhaps one of the, you talk about collapse, and here would seem to be an example of the possible reason for a collapse. We just price ourselves out of business, and the business has to move offshore or across the border or to China or whatever. Because we can no longer afford to do business. And that's a collapse, is it not?
Yeah. One thing I'll say about China, now, garlic being a massive counterexample, because Chinese garlic basically dominates U.S. industry.
Yeah.
But I don't foresee China. China has got more than enough of its own food production problems. China is going to be a massive net importer of food. We're not going to be seeing a lot of our food system move to China. That said, it certainly is one thing, but I think that, you know, U.S. farming in general has moved to mechanization for a half century. And I think that, you know, basically corn and soybean agriculture in the Midwest is essentially automated.
Right.
It takes very few workers to do it. And I think you're going to see California move more and more in that direction. There's already a lot of research going into places like, you know, University of California at Davis, which is like this agricultural research powerhouse, in sort of figuring out how to make the most you know, a lot of delicate fruits and vegetables are hard to mechanize, and they're breeding, coming out with new varieties and coming out with new machines and trying their best to figure out how to mechanize it. There will be limits to that, and I think that those limits that, you know, when there are crops that it's just impossible, they'll move to Mexico. But I think that in the labor aspect, what we're seeing is just this big push to mechanization that I think is going to accelerate as California reforms its wage laws.
Which is essentially moving from time to money.
Yes. It's substituting labor for capital.
Right, right. And so as long as there's lots of capital, I guess we'll be okay. But then here we are. So labor being one thing happening out here in California, there must be another thing that has us worried too, could be water. What they say about California is whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting.
That's right. So, yeah, with water, now I think we get into the real heart of my book, because what I say about California in terms of water is that agriculture has gotten so big there. We've become so reliant on stocking our supermarkets nationwide. California agriculture is also a massive exporter, a huge export of things like wine and wine grapes and obviously almonds, pistachios. So it's this agriculture powerhouse, makes billions and billions of dollars. And it's gotten so big and so efficient that it's overstripped its water resources. So what I mean by that is California does have this magnificent resource that feeds Central Valley farming, and that is the Sierra Nevada mountain range, which, you know, sit there all winter collecting snow and release that snow come spring into the summer. And that snow melt cascades down the mountainside and it used to feed these mighty rivers. And there are still rivers in the area, but they're completely controlled and dammed. And now, 80%, upwards of 80% of that snow pack is shunted onto these farms. And that's fine, except for the farm system has grown to where it's expanded beyond what it can grow with just that snowpack. And also historically, we're seeing the snowpack shrink. Because of climate change, we're seeing, you know, on average, there's no average year in California, got such a wild weather pattern, but the sort of mean snowpack is falling with time. And if you talk to scientists who study the climate, they say that climate change means that starting around mid-century, we're going to see real serious average declines in the snowpack. And so the way that farmers have been dealing with this is by tapping water from underground, these aquifers that have built up over millennia because of that, because there was, this water cascading down the mountain every year feeding these rivers. Some of it would drip down into the aquifer, and you get these magnificent aquifers. Well, farmers are extracting water from them so fast, even in good years for the snowpack, that the ground is sinking, the aquifers are depleted, and it's clear that this behemoth that's built up over the last century cannot go on like it is. There's just not enough water. You can't just keep and draining it out.
Well, they will. They will keep draining it out because that's their job. You know, they're farmers. They're growing crops. And right. So they're going to keep drilling holes in the ground and pumping it out. But then something's going to happen, it would seem, if you keep pumping the water out faster than you're putting it in. We see that happening here on California's Central Coast where – for years we've been pumping out more than we have been putting back in to the aquifer. And as a consequence, those wells closest to the coast now have salt water in them. And yeah. and there's a mighty fight over how to manage this situation between the state and the farmers themselves, farmers have become very, very clever with water use as well. I mean, where they used to have sprinklers, throwing water up into the sky, now they're using very intensive drip systems that carefully meter water like it really is the precious resource that it is.
Yes. So what happens is there's this thing called the Jevons paradox, and that it's pretty simple. All it says is that when you make something a lot more efficient, so you think, well, California farmers have gone from these wasteful sprinklers to these very efficient drip irrigation systems. That must mean that they're saving water. Let's say it takes a third less water to grow their crop, that's fantastic. They're using a third less water. But that's not what happens. So what happens is they use less water to grow each crop, and they make up for that by just growing more crops. They make it more intensive. And so instead of saving water, getting more efficient like that can end up costing you more water. And a good example would be the almond industry. The almond industry has gotten a lot more efficient. Basically the entire industry.
Well, can you hold that thought? We're going to take a quick break, Tom, and we'll pick up the almond industry and water when we come right back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Tom Philpott, who is the author of Perilous Bounty and You. We will be right back. We're going to pick up why our agriculture might collapse and what we can do about it. This is the Food Chain. Do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting, and that's what we do with water in a very dry climate like California. It's a very, very precious commodity. Tom was talking about how California was ideally plumbed for agriculture. The good Lord gave us the Sierra Nevadas to block the flow of moisture-laden air. It precipitates as rain and snow. We store it up there, and then we can use it all year long. Even though there's no rain falling from the sky during the summer, we can grow crops, and what a precious environment it is for growing crops. Is there any other place like California in the world, Tom?
Well, there's the other Mediterranean, the places around the actual Mediterranean, which are also, basically every Mediterranean climate in the world is used heavily for agriculture. Because there's so many ideal things about it. I don't know if there's a place that quite has
the geography.
Just the Sierra, like a mountain range like the Sierra Nevada. And, that's not the only mountain range California benefits from. Basically, the Rocky Mountains off to the east a little bit, they drive agriculture in the Imperial Valley. Valley down at the very southeast corner of the state is an incredibly productive area that is essentially a desert. It is a desert. It's part of a desert. But if you can if you can get a whole bunch of water into a desert, you can grow a lot of crops. And that's what they're doing there. And of course, it's, incredibly oversubscribed, this Colorado River, lots of people live in cities that rely on it, and they're having the same problem they're having in Sierra Nevada mountains, and that is a declining snowpack because of climate change. And so just another thing to worry about in your
another possible cause of collapse. You talked about the almond industry and the use of water for almonds. Go ahead with that.
Yeah, so I was just saying that the almond industry has done a very admirable job. I mean, they've got UC Davis, this great research institution right there. A lot of research has gone into how to figure out how to get the most almonds out of every drop of water. Hats off to them for that. But they've gotten so good at it that the industry has expanded so dramatically that the industry is definitely using more water than it's ever used before and taking up more land than it's ever taken up before, just because it, it's this paradox where when you make something super efficient, you can do it more cheaply, that juices demand for it, there's more demand for it, so you expand it, and so suddenly this attempt to save water ends up costing us more water.
The almonds are an incredibly good export crop too. Easy to package, easy to ship, valuable, good commodities.
Yeah, and super high demand throughout the world.
Right. So that's, you see that industry growing then.
Oh, yeah. Basically, It will grow for a while. I mean, the thing about the California almond industry also has excellent marketing, and they've done a great job of marketing almonds to places like India and China. And, you know, these are places that didn't have a big snacking culture. And, you know, and I think in both places, almonds were used in traditional cuisines, but they're used in recipes. And the industry has really, as those countries have expanded their middle classes, they've been successful at marketing this idea of, hey, you need a snack. You can't just not eat between lunch and dinner. And so they've successfully marketed them. I think the problem for almond growers is that when they can only get so expensive before consumers switch to a cheaper nut, and so that keeps the price from getting too high, and ultimately I think they'll oversupply the market. But I don't think they're there yet. I think we'll see, you know, lots and lots more expansion before it hits that point.
Yeah,
there'll be ups and downs.
Especially if it can be grown and produced and packaged without a lot of hands.
Yes. And it's also something, you know, almonds and pistachios both are crops that can only be grown in very specific areas with very specific weather conditions. And California has one of the best places in the world for that. And, you know, one of the assets that it has is UC Davis doing this incredible research.
Right.
So
right.
I don't think there's any other country that's going to compete with California almonds pistachios are different because of Iran is a major producer of pistachios. But I think that, you know, basically California has the almond market, so global almond market sewn up.
Good. And do you see the same conditions, the same danger signs in the Midwest that you see in California?
I see a different situation, but equally scary. So we were just talking about the sort of race to the bottom of the aquifer in California that's happening. What's happening in the Midwest is you've got what essentially is a race to the bottom of the topsoil store. So the Midwest is another just incredible place to grow food. It's got this incredible store of loamy, rich, organic matter heavy topsoil that kind of grew up over millennia of bison and prairie grasses and native people sort of managing it in a way. You know, since U.S. settlement and the sort of onset of, you know, the plow and crop farming, we've lost about half of that topsoil. And as I show in the book, we are really moving in the last 20 or 30 years, changes in farming there, mostly just the hyper focus on corn and soybeans, just two crops planted over a giant area, has led to conditions that we are losing topsoil at an alarming rate. And it's basically taking this incredible ecological asset and just mining it. Mm-hmm. And you know, topsoil grows, you can lose topsoil really fast, and it comes back very slowly. It's sort of, in that way, very analogous to the aquifer in California.
Yeah. Aren't they pretty much going away from the moldboard plow every year and starting to use seed drills, no-till for agriculture, which of course means they're using a lot of glyphosate, right?
They're using a lot of glyphosate, but here is the problem. So you hear that, hey, we're doing soil conservation because we're doing no-till agriculture. You know, move along, there's no problem here. But the real problem is the fact that you are growing two crops that are planted in the spring and harvested in the fall, and in between harvest and plant, you've got bare ground. So you've got no protection on the ground. And what's happening is we're getting these fierce late winter and early spring storms are blowing in and hitting bare ground and just sending soil on the move. And so we're seeing these massive erosion events based on just bare soil. And things like no-till might slow that down a little bit, but they're not sufficient to the problem. And the solution to the problem is really simple. It's just sort of diversification, just growing more crops than just corn and soybeans, and figuring out ways to protect the soil in that crucial, you know, winter, early spring season.
Well, the problem with diversification, of course, is that if you have a $500,000 combine that's designed for soybeans, you're not going to be growing rutabagas very long.
No doubt. And if you don't have infrastructure for buying a way to get your rutabaga to market, if you don't have sort of the middleman kind of infrastructure that exists for corn and soybeans, you've got a similar problem.
Yeah, then you're sitting out there in the heartland with a whole truckload of rutabagas and no place to go.
Yep.
So do you see a danger in that loss of topsoil? Do you consider that to be a possible cause of collapse?
Yeah, so it takes us from a very resilient, you know, a very resilient and robust place to a very vulnerable place. The thing about carbon-rich soil, the kind of soil that the sort of U.S. settlers took over, and it took over when they took over the Midwest in the middle of the 19th century, is that it's very resilient to drought,
right?
Because it traps water really well. It's very
resilient. Humus in it, and humus.
Yeah. It's resilient to floods because it holds together better. It doesn't run off as easy. And when you, as you lose that topsoil and you get poorer and poorer quality soil, what you get is you're super vulnerable to these things. And we know that climate change is going to bring stronger and stronger storms in the Midwest, and also periods of greater drought. Those two things are coming. We know that. We've already seen it. You know, documented in U.S. government studies about climate, we see that, you know, the just in the past 50 years, even in the past 30 years, like if you talk to a farmer who is, you know, 70 or 80 years old, they will tell you that they did not deal with the severity of spring storms that farmers are seeing now. And that's completely borne out by the data. And that trend is only going to get more extreme as climate change proceeds. And so going into climate change, instead of being in a resilient place, we're going into it in a very, very fragile place. And I think that that fragility is going to be exposed.
So what do we do? Now, that's where the title of your book comes in, Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming. Oh, yuck. But now, and how we can prevent it. So how do we prevent the collapse of agriculture?
You know, it's kind of funny how, you know, in some ways easy the answer to that question is, because we know how to break that cycle. We know how to productively keep land covered all year. We know how to...
But wait a minute. That means more time. Does it?
It does. Yeah.
And yeah, time being the most precious commodity in our agriculture, can we do it with money instead of time?
I think that there. One thing that I think is for sure is that more complex systems based on biodiversity, putting more crops in besides just corn and soybeans, it's more management intensive. Mm-hmm. That means that there's more to think about. There is almost certainly more labor involved.
You know, if you think about it, growing corn and soybeans, relatively simple.
Relatively simple, yeah. And you're
talking about biodynamic agriculture. You're talking very complex. You're talking about smart people.
Yeah, and I'm not even necessarily talking about biodynamic agriculture as much as I admire that system. I am talking about more biodiverse agriculture. I'm just talking simply more crops.
Right.
Like I profile a farmer in the book who is, in addition to corn and soybeans, is growing winter rye. So he's got a third of his fields covered with rye all winter and spring, and he harvests it in the early summer, and he's able to get another crop in after that. But he's got, and I went to his fields when Iowa in 2018 was just getting pummeled in the spring and early summer, losing massive amounts of topsoil, and his field was looking great. And he also, you know, has cows that roam through his corn, adding another bit of biodiversity after it's harvested, and, you know, working their manure in and fertilizing a cover crop that he has in that part of the field. So, and he's got this incredibly productive farm, and he's able to keep the ground covered and to keep the soil in place when those storms hit. And I think that that kind of agriculture, there's definitely a trade-off. And there are definitely huge political impediments and economic impediments based on the business interests that have grown up around the current system. But we know how to do it. We know how to do it better.
Well, do you think we will do it better? Do you think we'll come to the point where it will collapse and we'll have to do it better? Or we're going to keep muddling our way through?
I think avoiding the collapse would be a really, really smart thing to do. And I think that, you know, we have seen transformations in our society. Like we had this massive economic crisis starting in 1929 that bled into the sort of meltdown of European civilization that was World War II. And in that process,
well, we just ran out of time. But will we do it or won't we, Tom Philpott? Author of Perilous Bounty.
Oh man, that is hard. I think we will.
We will. Really, that's what I wanted to hear. We will do fine. Folks, this has been the Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain? Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.